Use coconut oil, use olive oil, use petroleum jelly. Okay. Nice, awesome, cheap stuff.
Yeah. These are all, again, household items.
It's easy. Yeah, but if you have olive oil, coconut oil, just make sure it's not the cooking coconut oil and the cooking olive oil. You know, it's more the topical for skin type.
Okay.
And those are absolutely safe to you. In fact, they're recommended.
It's good to know.
Yeah. I was hoping coconut oil. That seems to fix everything.
Yeah. I mean, I use coconut oil on my face, you know, and I feel like a lot of the things you've said there is like, you know, if it's good for your face, it should be good for down there.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Hello and welcome to the 40s Formula, your go-to place for insightful discussions on navigating your 40s and thriving in this transformative decade.
We're your hosts, Amanda and Jasmine, two women that are passionate about exploring the challenges and adventures that come with turning 40 and what lies ahead. Dr. Jess Shirin Sidhu actively incorporates the positive aspects of sexuality into her practice as part of an effort to decrease the stigma associated with sexual health. Dr. Jess also keeps herself updated with latest treatment options and technology to help her patients restore, maintain, or improve optimal sexual health. She is a regular participant in international sexual health meets organized by the International Society of Sexual Medicine. She is also well-versed in aesthetic gynecology with certification from different procedural courses attended with the European Society of Aesthetic Gynecology. Dr. Jess has acquired the only available certification for sexual medicine, the Fellow of the European Committee of Sexual Medicine. She has a special interest in menopause, being a member of the Australasian Menopause Society. She is a mother of two who divides her time between her kids, her husband, her clinic, and her outreach work. Today on the 40s Formula, we are so excited to welcome Dr. Jess Shirin Sidhu here. So welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I'm here.
No, we're so glad to have you. So Dr. Jess, we often hear that as women enter their 40s, they start to experience perimenopausal symptoms. And sometimes they face unexpected changes in their sexual health. And sometimes this can feel a bit isolating, confusing, and a lot of people don't openly discuss these changes. So given your experience as a GP who specializes in sexual health, what would you say are the most important things women in their 40s need to know about sexual health as they approach this time? And how can they feel empowered to make changes rather than feel concerned about what's going on?
It's such an interesting phase of your life, right? Like as a woman, we go through so many milestones. And then when you hit your 40s, is yet another milestone that you're dealing with. And I often like to think of perimenopause like a light bulb that's about to dim itself out. So you've got the huge glow in your 20s and your 30s. And then come your 40s, this flicker starts to happen. And sometimes the flicker goes on for quite a while before the light bulb goes gone. And that's when the menopause sort of kicks in. And I suppose because the change can happen across such a long period of time, and so many of the symptoms can be so subtle that we choose to ignore it.
Yeah.
And by general socialization messaging, women are meant to deal with so much. You know, we're the caregivers. So it's always others first, me last. So one of the things that I encourage women to do is, you know, even if you have symptoms like fatigue, body aches, don't just accept it. Just have this click moment or a light bulb moment, if you might, and go, maybe this is perimenopause. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is something, because I can't, in my 40s, suddenly start to feel this without a good, acceptable reason. There always is something to explain what I'm experiencing. And I suppose many people do think that perimenopause is the hot flashes. You know, it's got to be the hot flashes. And if I don't have them, then it's not perimenopause. But there's such a broad spectrum of symptoms that women go through. And the reason why I'm bringing up things like fatigue, it's because sexual health is not just things that happens in the department of the genitals. Mm. It's all these other things. And sex is complex and so interesting that way, that biological factors, social factors, interpersonal factors, relationship factors, intrapsychic factors, how you feel about yourself, social cultural factors all influence how you have sex. So if you're tired, you don't quite feel like it, and you're frustrated with your partner, it does impact your sexual life. And those sort of symptoms, mood disturbances, all kick in a hell of a lot during that perimenopause period. And in fact, the genital symptoms don't kick in so much in the early perimenopause period. It might happen a little bit later. And mood factors influences also things like lubrication down in the genitalia. So we go fine-tune how you think about perimenopause. Don't ignore the symptoms, because this can then lead up to a sexual health concern. And we all want to engage in some sort of sexual intimacy, and it's only because it creates that sense of grounding for us, the desire that I'm wanted, I'm desired, someone wants to hold me, someone wants to touch me, and just keeps us humbled. It keeps us well into the experience that we're safe. It creates this safety fencing for us. And that's why that sexual health or sex is so important to then generate that sense of emotional intimacy, and also gives us clues us in into the idea that, you know, we're still very much youthful. We're not aging.
We're not out to pasture yet.
Exactly.
You know, I never really thought of the safety element with sex. You know, you do think of, you know, the desire, the need to be wanted. But the whole safety thing actually makes sense. You know, like when you're hugging someone and you're just, you do feel secure. And it's something I never would have thought of in a sort of, you know, in a normal circumstance. So you mentioned that obviously there's different aspects. So you've got the biological and the physiological when it comes to sex and how that can really sort of make a difference in your desire. So when you get to your 40s, I say, as opposed to when you're in your 20s and your 30s, is it more physiological versus biological? Is there, I don't know, equal amounts? Like, how do you know what it is? Is it your mind? Is it your body? How would you know? And how would you then go ahead and, I guess, fix those if it's a way that you can do that?
It's so interesting, because we get asked this question every time by every person who walks in, whether it's the woman who's asking this question, whether it's a partner who's going, no, I'm convinced it's in her mind.
Yes.
She's just thinking about it. She's just obsessing over it. And I'm going, what is this fixation of us trying to figure out whether it's biological or physiological? Because just like our gut health, you know, our gut and microbiome in our gut, the amount of it we have, the type of it that we have, there's constant signaling back up to the brain. And it influences things like our mood. Mm. So it is inevitable that these two things co-influence each other. So it's never a situation of whether it is more biological or whether it's more psychological. It is an interplay of both. But often we go, okay, which one's the weakest link? You know, what can I work on first? It actually doesn't matter what you work on first. If you work, and let's say if you work on the biological element, it's going to have an impact on the psychological element. And if, let's say, the psychological element was your weakest link, you then become more motivated to go, okay, now I think I want to work on this part of it. It's how I'm seeing sex. It's my attitude towards sex. It's how I feel about myself. Maybe I don't have such a good reflection of my own body image. Maybe that's what's holding me back. I don't have vaginal dryness. I don't have pain when I have sex. But why is it I don't want it? Mm. So then this is the way I often tell women, it doesn't matter where you start. Start somewhere. Mm. Because you will then auto-identify which one is your weakest link. And then you will naturally veer towards going down that path of trying to fix that more. And sometimes we just need to find that weakest link so that we just get to just under that threshold such that we don't feel the symptoms anymore.
Are there any tips or suggestions that you can give to women who are unsure as to whether it is physical or whether it's psychological, whatever it is, certain things, maybe whether it's a lifestyle changes or whether it's a diet or exercise, that you think can help women feel more intimate or ready to be intimate?
I think women are quite intuitive. And generally when we are trying to suss out, is it more physical? Is it more psychological? I think the base where you can start with is to ask yourself, all right, let's go with something which is so simple, very simplified. When I'm having intercourse or when I'm having sex, regardless of whether it's intercourse or outercourse, what do I feel down in those areas, you know? Do I feel something negative? Is there pain? Is there discomfort? I don't exactly have pain, but I just feel I'm not lubricating like I should. It's kind of dry. Or when I'm being touched in other parts of my body, I realize that my arousal is not quite there. I don't get aroused the way I used to. So once you sort of identify that, no, I don't think I've got any of this, but then it's a lot about my state of mind. I don't know why. I can't explain why. There's no other better reason. I just don't feel like it. And then we've got to go down and go, all right, why don't I feel like it? Let's pull it back to general life. Am I motivated? Am I very stressed? Am I constantly anxious? Do I have a... Can I say shit?
Yeah, for sure.
Do I have a shitload of things to do? Yeah. Am I caring for kids in this part of my life? And many of us have got very young children in our 40s. The caregiver role is not due until two more decades down the road. And then you're thrown into perimenopause. You're having this flicker light bulb moment and your hormones are not functioning the way it should. It's kind of an unfair platform to raise kids on. Then some women are having an empty nest syndrome. You know, they might have had kids very early. Then the idea here is, what is my role now? What do I do? I'm done with these things that I've done over the last 20 years. I don't know what to do. Then you get a second lease of life. And then again, you're thrown into this depleted state of hormones and you go, uh-oh, now I feel like I can live again, but I don't know how to live again. So these are the things women can go through or can sort of tune into to figure out what's going on, whether it's more physiological, whether it's more psychological. Lifestyle changes are a big, big thing because with the hormone depletion, what then happens is that the way your body metabolizes things, the way your body utilizes nutrients changes big time. It changes big time. So getting into exercise. And it doesn't have to be something so vigorous, like, you know, just some sort of aerobic exercise. Just twice a week has been the recommended thing. And strength training. And that's particularly important because the shape of the body changes and then how you feel about your body changes. And then when you have this new lease of life, particularly for empty nesters, they feel really lousy about themselves. Mm. So strength training is really one of those things we tell people to get into. And really, it doesn't have to be very frequent. You know, three times a week, something very minimal is actually good enough to get women going. And generally, exercise has been shown to motivate people, especially when you're exercising without an intended goal. Just exercising. It's like for the beauty of it. You're not like, I need to get to some sort of a purpose or some sort of a place with this. Then it becomes work and stress-oriented. And for some people, the choice of exercise can be very much anxiety venting, anger venting, frustration venting. Boxing, you know, those sort of things are things that some women enjoy getting into in their midlife. And it just allows them to just de-stress through a physical element. So, yeah, these are the things that women have to pay attention to. I mean, food, diet, that's the sort of thing we tell people, you know, you do that from the get-go, regardless of what part of your life you're in. And we generally say, you know, eat a variety of things, you know, don't calorie count, but maybe count what you're eating, types of plants, types of just variety of things. And when you have so much variety, you can't possibly do one thing in a great quantity. You're doing little bits when you have variety. So we go, you know, make that a habitual thing from the get-go. So it's sustainable right through midlife. And that's where it's going to be most useful because your body's more vulnerable at that point. Your body's going to take quite a lot in your 20s and it's able to manage. But once you're in your 40s and 50s, you're not going to be managing so well anymore.
Yeah. And I think I love that you said, you know, basically there's not too much different that you would do in taking care of yourself through menopause that you wouldn't do otherwise, right? It's not like, oh, there's this magical menopause exercise that you must do. There's this magical menopause diet that you must do. It's like, no, the fundamentals that work in your 20s and 30s still apply in your 40s. Yep. It's simply that you need to be consistent with them. Exactly. And I think, you know, I work with a lot of women in this age group, right, in my practice. And it's like, I see this, they're always like, oh, when I was 20 and 30, I could lose those 5 kg so easily. And now they're stuck around my midsection. I hear you, right? I definitely hear you. But you also have to be realistic with what's changed in your life otherwise, right? Are you as consistent with your exercise? Are you as focused on your diet? Or is it perhaps that these demands that you've been talking about so beautifully are actually piling up and those habits are sliding?
Amanda, you know, I've been raving about the Meat Club for over a year now, and for good reason. It's honestly made my life so much easier.
Oh, also mine. I don't have to think twice about what I'm cooking. Their grass-fed beef, organic chicken, wild-caught seafood are so fresh and ethically sourced. It's food that I feel good about feeding my family.
And it's not just the quality, it's the convenience. The subscription model is perfect for busy families. Once you set it up, everything arrives fresh exactly when you need it. Plus, you get up to 15% off with every subscription order.
And let's not forget the exclusive rewards. They've got perks worth $140 for subscribers. Things like a chef's knife, a wooden chopping board, and even a $30 voucher. It's like they know exactly what all the home cooks need.
Honestly, I wish something like this existed years ago. It's been such a lifesaver for planning meals, and I know our listeners are going to love it too.
If you haven't tried the Meat Club yet, use code TFF12 for $12 off your first order. There's no minimum spend. Just visit themeatclub.com.sg and experience the difference for yourself.
And make sure to follow them on Instagram at themeatclubsg for recipes and special offers. The Meat Club, trusted by us, loved by families, and perfect for yours.
And now, back to the show. You know, so sometimes I think there's a kind of perception issue in addition to the obvious physiological issue of menopause.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of times one of the physiological changes that can happen is vaginal dryness. Can you explain what is going on and how that can impact comfort and pleasure? And what can women do if they are experiencing vaginal dryness?
Yikes. When you pull estrogen away from the vulva, it's like this key thing that gels everything together. And when that starts to dwindle in the perimenopause phase, it's not completely gone. You know, it's like on, off. I choose to come to work when I want to come to work.
And I love that metaphor. When I want to.
And when it starts to behave that way, what then happens is that you actually start to thin out the walls of the vagina. The glands that are there, they're still there, but they just don't work so well anymore. And the whole environment within the vagina starts to alter itself. And when we speak about vagina, you're actually talking about the canal. But what a lot of women experience is the dryness on the outside, which is actually the vulva. So women are recognizing changes there. And interestingly enough, there is a what we call an autoimmune process, a process in the body where the body makes faulty antibodies and it starts to sort of attack the skin a little bit more. It tends to happen in this midlife phase. And women start to thicken up the skin, dry out the skin, and vaginal dryness or just sensitivity in the area becomes quite a profound issue. In fact, I have to make it very clear that vaginal dryness is not a concern in just midlife. A lot of young women experience it too. And things that can be done when you experience vaginal dryness is, number one, just admit that it's there, right? All right, it's there. And stop being so resistive to lubricants. So some women go, I need to naturally lubricate. And a lot of us who engage in sexual intimacy, sexual intercourse, we don't have sex like animals where it's just quick, fast, get the job done and then you're off. You're making love in that process. You're romancing each other in that process. There's a lot more demand on natural lubrication. So using lubricants. And then we have a group of women who say, oh, look, I've used lubricants. It's not working. I still feel dry. And yes, the lubricants give you a slip and slide sort of sensation. Just takes off that friction at the surface. But dryness is skin deep. What about that feeling I get? Like, you know, things are stretching and it's just uncomfortable. What do I do about that? Then we go, do you moisturize your skin on a regular basis? Do you moisturize your face on a daily basis? Perhaps twice a day you do that. Why do you do that? It's because our body's demanding that hydration that we're not otherwise going to make through that aging process. So why aren't we being smart about it? Look into vaginal moisturizers, things that you use on a daily basis, not just before sex. And people then ask us, okay, so many lubricant on the shelves.
Yeah.
How do I go about
that? That was
going to
be my question, is how would you even know what's safe?
So generally most lubricants on the shelves are safe. Okay. But if you want to look at long-term safety, you want products that don't have a lot of parabens in it, because parabens have been associated with things like breast cancers, glycerine as well. So those sort of things, you want to reduce the doses in them, or you want to pick products that are paraben and glycerine free. So they're made on moisturizers that are based on plant cellulose. So those are the sort of things that are safer. If you're walking into a standard supermarket like in Singapore, you might not get a lot of that product.
Yeah, that's...
Get online.
Okay.
Get online and you will find no parabens, no glycerine, and then you go, bang, that's the one I want. Okay. And for women who are engaging in intercourse still very comfortably, they're going to go, okay, lubricants are a pain in the ass because I got to keep reapplying them. Yeah. And I go, how about you go for lubricants that are water-based but meant for the back passage?
Oh,
so,
interesting.
Okay. Anal lubricants.
Oh, interesting.
Because they're thicker. The anus is not designed for intercourse, and therefore they have very specialized, much thicker, longer-lasting water-based lubricants for that. Use that.
Oh,
use that for the vaginal area. Or silicone lubricants. Now, the downside of silicone is that it does stain bed sheets. So if you've got expensive bed sheets, oh my God, that's a bummer. So, but then try anal lubricants, because then they're a good alternative. They last long. You don't have to keep reapplying them every time. It's not interruptive then. Other things that can be done when it comes to vaginal dryness, then you're going into slightly more novel territory. Then you're going to something more medical. So if we spoke about estrogen causing the problem, the lack of it, let's dump estrogen back, you know, or let's dump what estrogen makes, which is hyaluronic acids. You have so much in the aesthetic world. People are injecting all sorts of things like hyaluronic acids. But these are hyaluronic acids, not in the form of fillers, not occupiers of space, right? They're not filling up gaps, but they're hyaluronic acids to just increase hydration. So hyaluronic acid are stuff that, you know, drags water molecules to the area. So you dump the thing in there, the hyaluronic acids that drags water, and they have got vaginal hyaluronic acids in the market. So
how are they applied? Is this a dumb question? Is it topical?
Yes. So
okay,
you apply
not
the vulva.
Injectable.
And then it's not injectable.
Okay.
It's on the vulva and then it gets absorbed and also in the vagina.
Okay.
But there are formulations that can be injected into the vulva.
Wow.
So that's then done at a clinic level, right? The doctors will have to inject it for you.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about that. I hate injections. Regardless,
regardless,
just a little bit of injection down there.
Below, it could be tricky, but
a lot
I've
of
never
it is done under
before,
anesthetic.
That,
so, you know, you don't really feel, but I suppose the thought, it's,
it's the thought, it's the,
Okay, speaking of topicals and moisture and vaginas, HRT application down below? Thoughts?
So then that's the, if you don't have the estrogen or if it's depleting, and you don't have to test it to confirm that you're depleting estrogen. It's very much a clinical diagnosis, right? You know, oh, I'm having dryness.
Yeah, I'm having
there is
symptoms.
No harm in using topical estrogens. In fact, topical testosterone as well, down at the level of the vulva.
Oh.
So many of us
I didn't know that was a thing.
I didn't know that either.
So our vulvas respond not to just estrogen. It is also very responsive to testosterone.
Oh.
And these two hormones are, in fact, required to maintain a good sense of hydration in that area. So you don't have that sticky, dry feeling. And that's what a lot of women want. In fact, a lot of younger women on birth control pills, and they're not even perimenopausal yet, but what birth control pills do is that they deplete estrogen and testosterone at the level of the vulva.
Oh,
and they'll
wow.
say, I'm on birth control, I need it, I don't want to get pregnant, but I'm really dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go, haha, all right, let's just replace.
I wonder if that also reduces desire as well then.
It does.
Yeah,
that's
interesting.
And because birth control increases a certain protein in the body, and when that protein levels are quite high, it binds testosterone.
Mm.
So testosterone becomes unavailable because it's all stuck to this protein, right?
Yeah.
And then I've got no free-floating testosterone
around.
And I need my
libido,
testosterone
right?
to keep me, to keep my libido up.
Yeah.
And then that's what happens in perimenopause as well.
Wow.
So the drop in the libido doesn't help. Other things that we do besides the hormones are going to real novel territory here. You're talking about lasers.
Mm-hmm.
So we do play with quite a lot of lasers.
Lasers?
Vaginal lasers.
Wow.
So vaginal lasers is becoming a territory that's more and more explored now, particularly in women who are thrown into menopause because of things like breast cancers or cancer treatment. So for them, it kicks in very prematurely. And the thought of using hormones, although there's many studies that has been shown that topical estrogens are safe, but I think a lot of doctors are still falling quite backwards.
Mm.
It's the idea of survivorship. You know, I've gotten cancer, I've gotten through it, I've survived it, but I'm too scared to even try anything.
Mm-hmm.
Although the data
yeah.
says it's okay,
yeah.
I feel it's not robust enough to go ahead and use it.
Yeah.
So it's actually very under-prescribed topical estrogens in our breast cancer survivors, which is, makes a very sad situation because many of them are on medications that actually depletes the estrogen and they are extremely dry and in a dire state when it comes to their sexual lifestyles. So lasers are a nice alternative for these group of patients as well. Yeah. This is not excluding other patients who want to try things like lasers, but we use carbon dioxide lasers, we use erbium YAG lasers. These are the two approved lasers, and they actually remodel the collagen and force hydration to be formed in the skin layers. They don't affect your pelvic floor in any way. It doesn't reach muscles, but that's the layer it works at.
Okay, I have another question. You just brought this memory up to mind. I get cupping quite regularly, oxygen cupping from my back. My therapist was talking about using cupping for vaginal rejuvenation, basically. Have you ever heard of this?
I haven't exactly heard about it. But if you think back as to how it works, it's actually tissue regeneration. Yeah. It's forced tissue regeneration.
Yeah.
And this is what the aesthetic field is all about now, you know, applying, causing controlled damage to induced forced healing.
Okay.
So like when a laser is applied, you leave some healthy tissue in between the laser and then you force your body to repair. Your body wouldn't otherwise repair at that rate.
Okay.
And cupping's kind of like this. All of these techniques are forcing repair and therefore creating regeneration. So it's all regenerative technology. Yeah. People have been doing it from a long time ago, like vaginal steaming. What's that? That's heat therapy to force regeneration. Yeah. So that's been going on for ages. It's just that we are fine-tuning it now.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing people shouldn't be doing this at home on their own.
I wouldn't advise it.
Says you, doctor.
Right. So let's say, you know, the kids have gone out and, you know, you're at home with your partner. Things are getting steamy. You haven't had a chance to go and buy some lubrication or do any of these things. Is there anything at home you can use?
Coconut oil, olive oil,
petroleum jelly. I don't know. Like, you know.
Absolutely.
Any of these safe or anything we should definitely be avoiding? Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Use coconut oil, use olive oil, use petroleum jelly. Okay. Nice, awesome, cheap stuff.
Yeah. These are all, again, household items.
It's easy. Yeah, but if you have olive oil, coconut oil, just make sure it's not the cooking coconut oil and the cooking olive oil. You know, it's more the topical for skin type.
Okay.
And those are absolutely safety. In fact, they're recommended.
Okay.
Oh, good. Yeah. It's good to know.
Yeah. I was hoping coconut oil, that seems to fix everything.
Yeah. I mean, I use coconut oil on my face, you know, and I feel like a lot of the things you've said there is like, you know, if it's good for your face, it should be good for down there.
That's what it sounds like.
I've interestingly had a patient who told me that she was using ghee.
Wow.
Which is the clarified butter. Yeah. But I can't make a recommendation on ghee. So if anyone's got tins of ghee at home, I can't make that recommendation. But for now, coconut and olive oil agree.
Yeah.
So you mentioned testosterone. Yes. Now, I think a lot of people, when they think of testosterone, they think of it as a male hormone. But how does testosterone apply to women? And, you know, like, can we use this to help increase our desire?
Absolutely. Testosterone, just like men have estrogen, women have testosterone. Of course, the quantities in which we have them are far more minuscule compared to what men have. So in general, when we do prescribe things like testosterone, it's still considered off-label. And the only reason is that we till this day have not formulated a form of FDA-approved testosterone that can be applied on the skin so that women, particularly postmenopause, and there's lots of studies, testosterone use in postmenopause is now approved. But we don't have a packet that says, this is testosterone formulated by women. Squeeze the contents out and just rub it on yourself.
Yeah.
So the formulations that we have to use are from compounded pharmacies. Now, compounded pharmacies, the drugs there are not FDA approved because when you compound drugs, there can be variability in the doses just with each bottle that you manufacture. And it's something a pharmacist is just sitting there and preparing based on a prescription that a doctor gives them. So it's not as well studied. So then you go, okay, it's questionable. I think I'm applying this much of the dose, but how much of it is actually getting into me, getting into my system to help with libido? It does help. Then the current recommendations from the menopause societies are saying, how about we use the male formulations? They come in little sachets or little pumps, but we pump out 1/10. Yeah. And then I am, as a doctor, I'm going, How in the world am I going to pump out one tenth?
Yeah,
it's like cutting pills, right? Yeah. It's like one fourth of this pill. It's like, how? What do you think I have at home to like make one fourth of a pill?
Do you know how I'm doing it? Because that's exactly what I'm doing. So I've got the male version.
Yeah.
And one sachet is 5 milliliters. Is that right? 5 grams?
Very small.
Yeah, whatever it is. And so I bought a 5 milliliter pump tube.
Yeah.
And then I was first using a syringe to figure out how much, you know, one, like half a milliliter or whatever it is, the dosage is. And then I eyeballed it. I'm like, okay, it looks like it's about a pea-sized amount. So I'm putting it in this pump thing. And so now I pump it out. It's like 2 or 3 pumps. I'm like, aha, and this lasts me like 10 days. So I've figured it out now. I know how to get.
But like, think of the level of work you just described to do that.
I've got to tell you, it's messy when you're first like putting it in. Just can someone please invent?
Actually, that's a business idea.
Yeah.
Yes. Get into that.
An easy dispense for
testosterone.
Because it would take off, really, because many, many, many women describe having a low libido.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are, of course, so many other factors influencing that libido, but hypoactive sexual desire syndrome is a real problem that one third of women in menopause experience, or midlife, forget menopause, in your 40s already, you're starting to experience that.
That's just, so what you've just said, hypoactive
sexual desire disorder.
I mean, that's like, it's a clinical term.
It's a proper diagnosis.
And I just would have thought, oh, this is a normal thing that happens. But actually, is it normal? I mean, I don't know. Like,
as humans, we're in the habit of labeling things, right? So we always want to give something a name. And it gives us a sense of security. All right, it's been labeled. This is what it is. Because it gives us an idea, I can now do something about it.
Yeah.
Show me the data. What's the evidence? If I have this, what can I do? Mm. So again, sense of safety that comes with labeling. And the problem comes with mislabeling things. So when you've been given a diagnosis like hyperactive sexual desire disorder, it's really a condition that's been there for weeks, you know. It's been there for weeks and there's no better explanation for this lower desire. It cannot be explained by a relationship issue, meaning it's not situational. I feel sexual desire with this other person, but not with my partner. Then that's not hyperactive sexual desire disorder, right? That's something's going on with that relationship. And there's no other better explanation, like a medical condition, like a skin problem. Like, there's no other better explanation other than for the impact of perimenopause or menopause causing this problem. And it's a real issue. One third of women experience it, but how many women actually come and speak about it? Many of us normalize it. And the worst part is we might normalize it, but when we approach our doctors about it, it's number one, difficult to speak about. And when we do, it might be trivialized, right? And then they go, no, it's quite normal for you to feel this way in this part of your life. And then you go, hold on, I'm at the peak of my life now. Do I really need to feel this way at this point in my life? Because sex and just being sexually intimate with my partner is something that I actually rely on. It fills my intimate bank. It fills up my emotional bank. And I'm currently running on empty. Yeah. And that's why sex is important. It's not the act or the mechanics of sex. It's the reward system at the end of it. And we are reward-seeking beings. We would do something because it's rewarded us. We would dine at that same restaurant because the food's good and it triggers off good hormones in us. I like it. I'm coming back. If I like sex, I'm coming back too. But if I don't like it, I'm not going to want it.
And if you don't want it, that's it. It's like, you know, the whole purpose of humans is to procreate. Yeah. And, you know, like, it's kind of... Yeah, it makes sense. Totally makes sense. Never would have put it in like that whole, you know, put it together, but it totally does make sense. We have loved your conversation with us today. I think you've given us a lot of food for thought, a lot of things to think about when it comes to women in their 40s and sexual desire. But we do have one last question for you, and that is, what's your 40s formula? What would you say to women who are in this phase of their life? What can they do to make them feel like they're living their best life within the 40s? Is there some kind of advice or mantra you'd like to share with us?
I would normally say don't take the shit that's being thrown at you, you know, and go, okay, so I've got rubbish being thrown at me. Maybe I should get a better bag to catch that. So don't let it just hit you and just go, you know, okay, this is what I'm experiencing. Just get into the acceptance mode and go, I'm experiencing this, but I'm not taking it. Can I do something about it? So just don't normalize it. You know, a lot of people come to us, is this normal? No, it's not normal. It's common, yeah, but it's not normal. Common doesn't make something normal. Mm. And that's what I tell my women, you know. And then, and sometimes we find comfort in the fact that things are common. And that's because then we don't feel alone.
Yeah.
But again, not normal. Mm. Common, but not normal. So that's the advice I'd give women. I'd say, you know, that's the one thing you can do. Just that acceptance. And then with acceptance comes a potential proper labeling of what you're experiencing. And then going, how can I make it better? Because then you can go down the therapeutic route. Whether it's something medical or non-medical, there is a route. There is a formula.
Yeah,
from that point.
Yeah, get shit done, but don't take shit.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jess. No, it's been wonderful having you here.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. Want more from the 40s Formula? Every Friday, we'll be sending our 4Play Friday newsletter direct to your inbox with 4 hot topics, tips, and trends personally curated by Jasmine and Amanda.
All you need to do is visit the40sformula.com and sign up with your email address. That's the FORTIES formula.com. This is Paul, our editor.
He's a 25-year-old unmarried Singaporean guy listening to the ramblings of 12 older women on everything from menopause to weightlifting to sex. So, Paul, what's your thoughts on today's conversation?
Sex, sex, and sex. Plenty of sex is probably one of those aspects in our lives which we often overlook, especially for you guys in, you know, probably the 40s bracket with different various bodily changes. So, you know, there's no shame in using some lube, you know, wink wink. And of course, you know, stay healthy, stay hydrated, eat healthily, and I'll see you guys in the next one.
Guys, you know how much we love coffee. And if you want to show us some love, you know, you can get us one.
Just visit buymeacoffee.com/the40s formula. Cheers. Before we go, please remember to hit subscribe and take a moment to support the 40s Formula by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Your reviews will help us to reach more people and allow us to continue to bring valuable content. It should only take a moment, and it's a free way for you to support the show.
You can also stay updated with the 40s Formula by following us on Instagram at the40sformula, all one word. We share behind-the-scenes insights, episode updates, and much more, so please be sure to hit that follow button.
We appreciate your time and support. Thank you for being part of this community, and we'll be back next week for more empowering conversations with inspiring guests.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you. Awesome. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
No worries.
I feel like we've had people talk about sex before, but this was like really specific and really to the point. And I feel like it's given a lot of great information.
Yeah, especially about audience. The lubricants. I had no idea that you could use, you know, I don't say anything. Obviously, there's like a limit, but, you know, just, yeah, coconut oil, whatever you got on hand.
No, you can.
And again, parabens and glycerin.
Glycerin,
those are the two things to avoid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Very, very helpful.
Thank you so much.
No worries.
It's been amazing.
Thank you very much for having me here.